From the Moan Broadcast Center, this is Take 2, me Martinez. New year means new laws you need to know about. And this time around, there's plenty of pandemic-influenced legislation that could change the way you live in 2021. Plus, police reform got a lot of air last year, but will that help blow the winds of change as the calendar flips and the coronavirus stays top of mind? That and more is all ahead on Take 2. Stay with us. From 89.3 KPCC and KPCC.org, this is Take 2. I'm Martinez. Feliz Año Nuevo. Now, while 2020 is now behind us, the coronavirus continues to spread in Southern California. Here in Los Angeles County, one person is infected with COVID-19. How about this number? Every 6 seconds. That's according to L.A. Mayor Eric Garcetti, who spoke to CBS yesterday.
This is not only going to come for somebody that you love, this is going to possibly come for you. And so everything we do is either life-saving or life-taking at this point.
Yeah, that infection rate is really a staggering statistic. And so officials are watching the numbers to see what kind of surge happens tied to the holidays when people may have traveled to see their friends and family. In an effort to curb the spread of the virus, health officials are now requiring a 10-day quarantine for all leisure travelers arriving in LA County from anywhere outside of Southern California. This new order also prohibits hotels and short-term rental operators from offering rooms to people wanting to come here just for a vacation. Now, with a bleak 2021 already underway, we want to help get you answers to all of your coronavirus questions. And with us today is Anne Ramoyne, professor of epidemiology at the UCLA Fielding School of Public Health. Professor, thanks once again for joining us.
It's my pleasure to be here. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you. Now, let's start off with the latest case numbers here in LA County. Can you break down those numbers for us? And have we seen any surges from Thanksgiving and Christmas gatherings? Is that the surges that we're getting in those numbers?
Well, as you mentioned, and the mayor just said, we're now seeing record numbers of cases. One case of COVID-19 recorded every 6 minutes. That's pretty impressive. In terms of a number. And yeah, we're absolutely seeing an increase that appears to be this directly related to the travel and gatherings that we saw at Thanksgiving. This was exactly what we were talking about prior to the holidays and letting people know that, you know, this virus takes advantage of all of our natural instincts to gather and spreads very, very effectively when we get together with family and let our guard down and get together inside.
Now, we know hospitals are overwhelmed with patients. I mean, how are hospitals faring right now? Is the county doing, and what is the county doing when it comes to the number of available ICU beds? I mean, we've been hearing really horror stories for the last couple of months, Professor, on all this.
Well, it's true. In Los Angeles right now, we're the hospitals cannot keep up with the surge of cases that we're seeing here. We know that our hospitals are making room because they've run out of beds in gift shops, in chapels, in administrative space. They're doing everything that they can to be able to make space because there are so many people flooding the hospitals right now. We know that ambulances have been delayed being able to offload patients into hospitals. So they've been, you know, there's been a long wait from somebody being in an ambulance to be able to actually getting care. And then once you're in the ER, also that care is delayed. And that's just because it's not even just enough about the number of beds that we have, but also the number of staff that are available to be able to take care of people. And this is really important to think about because it's not just about COVID-19. The strain of these COVID-19 cases that is putting on these hospitals means that if you get into an accident or if you have a heart attack or a stroke or need urgent medical care, it's going to mean that you will also be potentially delayed in getting care because there are just not enough beds and not enough people who can attend to you. So we're definitely in a very precarious situation right now. We are in a surge of cases that, as many people have said, is like a tsunami. We are in a viral tsunami of cases.
I got to admit, I've never been more careful as a driver than I have been in the last few months. I mean, I'm already a very boring driver, Professor, but I'm constantly looking around to make sure no one's near me and that I get home as safely as possible anytime I have to go out in the street.
I think you're making a really important point, and I'm going to double down on that point for you. So what this means to people, we're going to do, everybody knows, we've gone through this mantra, you wear a mask, you social distance, you use hand hygiene, all the things we know we're supposed to do. But this is also a time not to take chances because of this, because we know these hospitals are overwhelmed. So I'll give you, my husband wanted to get up on the roof to do something the other day.
No.
And I told him, absolutely not.
Nope.
Getting on the roof. This is not the time to clean out the gutters, to do anything that can be delayed, because we really just have to do the best we can in all circumstances to drive down that need to go to the hospital. So people who don't need to go for minor things are likely going to be putting things off. Now, if it's something really important, you know, you should always talk to your doctor. You should always take advice from your doctor and know what to do. But for very, very obviously minor things, it's a good idea to wait.
Now, speaking of other things we shouldn't be doing, that's traveling. And earlier I mentioned the order requiring travelers to quarantine. Can you explain more about how it works and who it applies to?
So the new guidelines related to travel here are that if you come back to Los Angeles, you need to quarantine. And that's very important. That's because we're seeing so much travel, and we've seen, and we know that there is a lot of COVID in the community. So the deal is you want Californians to stay home in the region and to avoid non-essential travel. But if you do travel, anyone traveling to visit family members for any non-essential reason who enters LA County from anywhere outside the Southern California region needs to quarantine themselves for 10 days. And that means that they need to stay at home or find some other, you know, lodging or some other way to avoid contact with others. It means don't go out to grocery stores, don't go to restaurants, don't go to pharmacies, don't run errands. Whatever you can do, you stay home. Have food delivered if you can. But the point is, we want to keep people from circulating in the community and potentially spreading more virus. Now, there are people who are exempted from this, and this is licensed healthcare professionals, people who are working for essential government, people transiting through LA and not staying overnight, and people who are in various categories of film or media production, collegiate sports teams, etc. Mm-hmm. But you know, we know travel and intermingling, especially during these holidays, is very, very high risk, and we need to be doing everything we can right now to be able to keep people from adding to this spread of the virus that we're seeing right now.
And the order really only works unless people are adhering to the honor system, right? But I don't know, Professor, if I can trust, or maybe I've given up hope that people will do that.
I know everybody is really tired. Believe me, I understand it. I really do. But everybody needs to do their part right now. Everybody can do their part in reducing the spread of this virus. I mean, I am very, very concerned about our hospital system, about how we're going to be able to keep up with this, with the number of cases that we're seeing. We are in a very precarious situation. I mean, that's the truth of the matter. So everybody should do their part. I know it's hard. I know it's tiring. We're all tired, but now is the time to be more vigilant than ever before. If you think about it in terms of your risk of getting infected right now and how you want to live your life now as compared to a few months ago, back in August, we estimated that 1 in 800 people walking around LA County were potentially infected with COVID-19 and able to pass it to others. Then right before the holidays, before Thanksgiving, it was 1 in 145 people. right around the Christmas holidays, it was down. I've heard estimates anywhere between 1 in 60 and 1 in 90 people in LA testing would be positive with COVID-19, able to spread it. And it's probably an even lower number now. So when you think about that, think about your risk right now of coming in contact with somebody who has COVID-19, potentially doesn't know that they have it and can spread it. It's very, very worrisome. And so your risk of doing the things that you were doing before the holidays and earlier on are not going to keep you as safe. It's not as safe. You have to consider how much the risk has gone up of any one person coming in contact with somebody else who has COVID-19.
Yeah, as it is, if you've gone to the supermarket in the last few days, you've probably been near someone that has tested positive or is positive. I think we have to assume that, don't we?
Absolutely. I think it's really important to remember that.
We're talking to Anne Ramoyne, professor of epidemiology at the UCLA Fielding School of Public Health, about the latest on COVID-19 here in Southern California. Professor, we're also seeing a new variant of the virus. At least 6 cases of the new strain have been detected in California, 4 in San Diego, 2 in Big Bear. What do we know about this variant?
So this variant, this UK variant that we're talking about, the data that we have so far suggests that it is significantly more contagious than your quote unquote standard variant of COVID-19. And what that means is it's more easily passed from person to person and is responsible for what we're seeing in the UK now, where we're seeing this exponential spread of the virus. Now, I think an important thing for people to keep in mind when they're thinking about this particular variant is that many of these cases that have been detected, not only just here in the United States or in California, but throughout the U.S., are in people who do not have a history of travel. Now, I know that there is a case in Big Bear where somebody may have been in the U.K. recently, and so there is one that may be linked to travel. It's still unclear if it actually is linked to travel or not. But what I think is really important, the cases in San Diego and case in San Bernardino, these people did not have a history of travel. And that's really significant because what that means is they got this in the community. So somebody else gave it to them. And so they didn't get it because they were traveling somewhere where we know this variant has been spreading. And that just suggests that it's already circulating in the community. And we just haven't done enough sequencing of the virus. We don't have good viral surveillance here in the United States. And we're just now starting to catch up, realizing we need to start doing some of this viral. We need to actually do a lot of viral surveillance. And as you shine a flashlight in the dark and you're going to see something. And that's, I think, what we're seeing here is that it's here. We know it's here. And we should be concerned. It's not just this variant from the UK that's important. There are variants that have been identified in South Africa, in Nigeria, and other places. Yeah. And the more that this virus is spreading, the more opportunities it has to mutate. And so this high rate of transmission is really important because we could see additional mutations. And while we think that the vaccine will work against these particular variants, we need to be very thoughtful and cautious going forward and monitoring this, because we could eventually see strains that may not be as susceptible to the vaccine.
And all of the same things we've been doing, washing hands, masks, staying away, all that still applies, as always.
All still applies. In fact, that should be the big takeaway here. Hey, we have a variant that is much more contagious. What can I do? Well, it means you need to be really, really vigilant about wearing that mask, social distancing, avoiding gatherings, because a virus is stopped the same way. We can reduce transmission the same way that we always have, all of these things that we've been doing so far. That's how you're going to reduce the spread of these particular variants. But it means these little breaks in protocol are more important. Those times you're forgetting to wear your mask or you get together with family or friends, they're more risky because this variant is going to take advantage of that.
All right, now to the vaccine. Here's LA Mayor Eric Garcetti on CBS's Face the Nation yesterday talking about the vaccine, the current pace of the vaccine distribution here in LA.
We are at a pace right now to deliver vaccines in Los Angeles over 5 years instead of over half a year.
So on that note, Professor, how is rollout of the vaccine going, and what hurdles is the county facing when it comes to distribution?
You know, I think that that we're facing the same hurdles that so many places are facing, and that's that that we just don't have the infrastructure in place to be able to deliver vaccine as quickly as we need to into all the communities that we need to give them to. We are in Los Angeles County is the most populous county in the nation. And so we have a very big task ahead of us. And while the development of the vaccines has been an incredible feat of science and really an amazing accomplishment, it's the getting the vaccine developed is part one. Now part two is getting people vaccinated and getting that vaccine into people's arms. And you know, I've spent my entire career working in places like the Democratic Republic of the Congo, working on mass vaccination campaigns. It's always wonky when you get it, when you're getting started. There are going to be kinks to be you know,
ironed
smoothed
out.
But we really do need to work these things out as quickly as possible and really ramp up and get really creative about how we're going to be able to do this when we know that we just don't have the infrastructure. You know, the other thing that the mayor said is that the federal government can't tell local and state governments to do something and then not give aid. You know, we need the resources to be able to get these vaccines out to all of these people here in LA County, and that's no mean feat.
The best vaccination against fear is facts, and that's what you've done. Anne Ramoyne, professor of epidemiology at the UCLA Fielding School of Public Health and director of the Center for Global and Immigrant Health, thank you very much once again.
It's my pleasure.
All right, police reform got a lot of air last year, but will that help blow the winds of change as the calendar flips and the coronavirus still stays top of mind? That's coming up next when Take Two continues in about 60 seconds. Stay with us.
But at your best, you are love. You're a positive, motivating force within my life. Should you ever feel the need to wonder why, let me know, let me know.
Back now with more Take Two on 89.3 KPCC and streaming at kpcc.org. I'm A. Martinez. It is a new year, and the hope of many who took part in the 2020 Black Lives Matter protests is that 2021 will bring a new relationship between LA law enforcement and communities of color. There's a new LA County District Attorney, George Gascon, and an array of leaders on the LA City Council and the County Board of Supervisors who've pledged to address police reform, so change could be ahead. However, what would it look like? Today, we start a series of conversations with experts and stakeholders, each giving their take on what's ahead. And for our first installment, we welcome back Priscilla Ochen. She's a professor at Loyola Law School, specializing in criminal law. She's also a member of the Los Angeles Sheriff's Oversight Commission. Welcome back, first to Take Two.
Thanks so much for having me.
Now, it feels like we should start with LADA George Gascon. He's had the job less than a month, but he's already facing internal resistance to some of his reforms. First, remind us of the promises that he made that got him elected, especially when it comes to prosecuting cases in LA County.
Yeah, so Gascon came in with a strong mandate to deliver transformational change to the way we do public safety in LA County. For most of, you know, the last few decades, public safety has been synonymous with policing, prosecution, and imprisonment. And Gascon's election promised to be a sea change. And so when he came into office, he implemented a number of different important reforms and initiatives, including the elimination of cash bail for a number of different kinds of offenses, particularly misdemeanors. He's directed prosecutors not to charge certain kinds of enhancement, like gun enhancement, gang enhancements, which disproportionately sent young Black and Brown people to juvenile detention and to jail and prison. In LA County, he eliminated the practice of charging juveniles as an adult, as well as seeking the death penalty. So these were significant changes. But the biggest hope, I think, for many of us here in LA County, particularly in the activist community, was that Gascon would hold law enforcement accountable for the rampant abuses that are occurring on patrol, that are occurring in our jails, the excessive use of force in cases like the death of Andres Guardado, Anthony Kizzee, and many others. So he came in with a strong mandate, not just to produce reform, but to produce transformational change in LA County in terms of how we do public safety. And he began to deliver on that mandate on December 7th. And as you said, he faced significant opposition from district attorneys in his own office as a result.
Yeah, a lot of pushback. Did that surprise you right off the bat?
No, because we have been in a status quo that has produced the largest jail system in the country, that has produced a county, LA County, that sends the largest number of people to jail or in prison on an annual basis in the country, that has produced one of the largest number of people who, a number of individuals who are sent to death row, all of whom are people of color in LA County. So there is an entrenched set of interests that are represented by the district attorney's office that was run by Steve Cooley and then run by Jackie Lacey. So there's a particular way that they have done things which has produced significant numbers, again, of Black and Latino and poor folks who are in jail, folks with mental illnesses, folks who are homeless. And when you want to produce that kind of change, that's when you meet resistance. I think that that signals that there is change afoot when resistance is put up to the kinds of policies that Gascon is trying to implement here in our county.
Now, last week, the union representing deputy district attorneys, the people that Gascon oversees, sued him. And the union disagrees with his new policy directing them not to seek sentencing enhancements. This is where prosecutors can argue to extend a defendant's prison term based on certain circumstances, such as gang-related crimes. Professor, what is at issue in this case, and why is it such a major point of contention?
Yeah, so the Association of Deputy District Attorneys is arguing that the changes that Gascon is implementing, these policy changes, restricting their ability to charge enhancements, which in many cases can double or triple the sentences that a defendant may face in a particular case. They argue that this is a violation of their oath as prosecutors, and they argue that it violates state law. I think this is really a disingenuous argument because prosecutors have discretion to either seek these kinds of charges, these enhancements, or to set them aside, whether it's three strikes or gang enhancement or gun enhancements. These kinds of enhancements are set aside routinely at the discretion of the district attorney's office. It was done under Steve Cooley, it was done under Jackie Lacey, and it's done in prosecutors' offices across the country. And so, it reeks of this idea that, of this notion that the district attorneys, the line district attorneys, the professional staff, are just simply resistant to the kind of change that Gascon is trying to bring forward. And importantly, I think it's important for us to understand that the way that these enhancements are often used is sort of as a cudgel to coerce people into pleading guilty for crimes, to negotiate over whether a sentencing enhancement will be applied or not. Mm-hmm. And so by enacting this policy restricting their use, Gascon has taken off the table the kind of enhancements that significantly increase the length of time people spend in prison, which significantly increases the population of people in jail and prison here in LA County and in the state of California. But it's also taken away a significant tool of prosecutors that is used to coerce people into guilty pleas. And you see the line prosecutors, up in arms about the elimination of that tool. And again, I think it's a disingenuous argument. I don't think it will go very far when it's set to be heard in February.
Professor, on holding law enforcement responsible, or at least accountable, I know that there's a new law in the books, 1506, that the state attorney general will investigate incidents in which police kill anyone who is unarmed. On this specific thing, does that in a way take George Gascon off the hook from going after police officers that may be charged or maybe at least accused in a situation like this?
No. So there's two big changes. There's the state law that you mentioned that that submits these cases to the state attorney general's office. But there's also a change in the standard for use of force for police officers, AB 392, which further restricts, or, you know, I wouldn't say that there was a whole lot of restrictions in the first place, but it puts additional restrictions on when police can use deadly force. So the combination of these two things are significant, but it doesn't take the district attorney out of the equation. One, district attorneys will still be responsible for investigating allegations of criminal misconduct by police officers, whether it's the sheriff's department or the LAPD. They'll also be involved when there are allegations that the individual was armed or other kinds of misconduct. You know, we have around 300 deputies that have been put on a Brady list that the district attorney's office will need to sort out how they want to use information once it's turned over. How will they use officers that have some history of excessive force or misconduct? Gascon has said that he will investigate old cases where there are allegations of misconduct in terms of the gathering of evidence or in the prosecution of the case. So there is still a significant amount of work to be done by the district attorney's office in addressing not just deadly use of force by law enforcement, but also misconduct more broadly that doesn't fall under the purview of the attorney general's office.
Talking to Priscilla Chen, a professor at Loyola Law School, specializing in criminal law. She's also a member of the Los Angeles Sheriff's Oversight Commission on the LA Sheriff's Department and the commission that you're on to oversee it. Sheriff Alex Villanueva has had a contentious relationship with lawmakers and with the commission. Do you have a sense if the department will become more of a willing partner in these changes that we've mentioned so far?
Hey, look, I'm a hopeful person. I'm optimistic. Hope springs eternal. I'm open to that happening. But over the last two odd years, the sheriff has revealed himself to be someone who is just fundamentally opposed to the kind of transformational change that we need when it comes to public safety. He has blocked the commission's attempt to root out deputy criminal gangs that exist in the sheriff's department. He has blocked our attempts to try to rein in COVID-19 and the spiraling populations in our jails after they were initially reduced. And the list goes on and on and on. He has blocked our attempts to subpoena information. So I hope that the sheriff will take a hint from the voters who passed Measure R, which calls for 10% of all unrestricted county dollars to be put into community development and to community reinvestment, and the election of a person like Holly Mitchell to the county board of supervisors, and the election of Gascon as significant indicators of what our community wants, which is not more policing, which is not more jails. What we want is investment in our communities and a different way of pursuing public safety. Again,
but you know what it sounds like? It sounds like, Professor, that for you, hope and trust when it comes to Sheriff Alex Villanueva are all but gone.
Look, I'm open to the sheriff coming forward and changing his tune.
What could he do? What could he say? What could he say to you as a member of the commission? What could he say? Something, say one or two things that Alex Villanueva could institute in 2021 that are achievable.
So one thing is that he can have a serious policy with regard to deputy gangs and demonstrate that he is terminating deputies that are participating in these gangs that foment violence in communities. You can look at Compton. We can look at the allegations in the Andres Guardado shooting. You know, he has said that he's taking essentially a hands-off approach as recently as our last meeting. He could be serious about reducing the population in our jails. You know, as a result of COVID-19, our population went down to about 12,000. It's creeping it back up to close to 15 and 16,000. At any given time, we have almost a quarter of our population in quarantine. That's dangerous in and of itself. And it's a danger to public health. He could comply with our request for information and take seriously the recommendations we make regarding things as important to our community as excessive use of force around issues related to COVID-19, around issues related to how women are treated in our facilities with regard to sexual assault and sexual abuse. So again, the list goes on and on. You can talk about Max Huntsman and the investigation into misconduct around the Kobe Bryant incident. So there are at least four things on the top of my list that if the sheriff shifted his position, I would be more hopeful. But at this point, as recently as our last meeting, the sheriff has given us no indication that he intends to embrace the transformational change that we need in LA County.
In case people forgot about Kobe Bryant, that is when deputies were sharing photos of the crash site among each other, which was something that they were not supposed to or allowed to do. Professor, when it comes to concrete things that we might be able to see out in the community on the streets that are going to be different in 2021, what would you say are some things that really will make a difference, that we'll understand and be able to notice right off the bat?
Well, I think one is the reinvestment of dollars that Measure R, as Measure R and Measure J will call for. So Measure R was passed earlier this year. Measure J was last year. Measure J was passed more recently in November. And that calls for a community reinvestment of dollars away from policing and into our communities where they're needed most, especially because of the economic catastrophe that this pandemic has been. I think we'll also see it in terms of our jail populations. When the bail policy is fully implemented, I think that will result in a number of people being released from custody or not being held in custody and being able to fight their cases from home with their families, where they can continue to work, keep a roof over their heads. I think that's a huge policy initiative. I think we'll see it with regard to the death penalty and the reopening of cases that Gascon has promised. And hopefully we'll see it in terms of holding officers that violate their oath to protect the public, that kill people while on duty, that they will be held accountable. And that's just something we haven't seen in LA County for decades. So I think those areas are places in the next year where we'll see some major changes in how LA County does business when it comes to policing and jailing people in our community.
Priscilla Chen, professor of law at Loyola Law School, specializing in criminal law. She's also a member of the Los Angeles Sheriff's Oversight Commission. Professor, as always, thank you very much.
Thank you so much for having me. It's good to be here. Happy New Year.
All right, new year does mean new laws that you need to know about. And this time around, there are plenty of pandemic-influenced bits of legislation that could change the way you live in 2021. Hear all about them when Take Two continues. Stay with us. Back now with more Take Two on 89.3 KPCC and wherever you get your podcasts. I'm A. Martinez. So, new year, new you, right? Yeah, well, it's the same thing for the state of California. New year and a new round of laws going into effect. But this year's laws are a little different than usual, in part because the pandemic threw off the legislative schedule, so lawmakers wrote and debated some of them in record time. Joining us to break down what these laws are and how they'll impact our lives is John Myers, Sacramento Bureau Chief for the Los Angeles Times. All right, now, John, let's break down by topic, starting with the pandemic. So what new laws are we talking about here, and how will they change our lives as we go through this surge in cases right now?
Well, what I think is interesting about the group of laws that we have on the books now in this topic is that they are very immediate for Californians. A lot of things have happened in Sacramento. There's a delay time for you to understand there's a new law. These really have impact right now. I would say at the top of the list are a couple of things. Mandatory notification to workers within 24 hours who might have been exposed to someone with COVID, and an expansion of workers' compensation for those who might have contracted the virus on the job. Now, both of those laws are in effect only for a couple of years, but they are very much about the workplace. And then behind those, I would also point to one that requires skilled nursing facilities. And we know those have been places that have had especially painful outbreaks of COVID. Those skilled nursing facilities in California have to report COVID deaths to state public health officials within 24 hours, state and county. And that's a really big deal too, because we had delays in notification about what was going on at those facilities earlier last year that caused a lot of the problems. Those things I think are very immediate, and a reminder that COVID is really impacting the workplace and certainly the care of older Californians.
Yeah, and also what we buy, right? Because that's one of the things that I think a lot of people got caught off guard with, is that they'd go buy some of the same things that they would normally buy, and the price would go up. And now there are laws to change that.
Yeah, we've had laws on the books in California in the past about price gouging during emergencies, these people who want a 200-300% upgrade on what something costs. What was unique about the coronavirus pandemic, of course, is that we had people who got into the market of selling things they'd never sold before, right? The person who went to the grocery store and loaded up on toilet paper and then started selling it on their own. Those practices are now part of state price gouging laws and protections against price gouging. And also, the law was passed last year by lawmakers to ensure that online selling is covered the same way as old traditional brick and mortar stores in terms of price gouging. So a few more protections there to try to avoid what we all lived through in 2020.
Now, 2020 was significant also because of the mass protests for racial justice, especially after the death of George Floyd. Let's talk about some of the new California laws going into effect that address racial justice.
I think most notable, people are going to remember that there was an effort here in Sacramento and now is on the books for California to have the first in the country task force to consider the idea of reparations for slavery. This is a 9-member task force. It is supposed to convene by this summer, appointed by the governor and legislative leaders. It does not say for sure that there will be some kind of state government funded reparations for slavery, but will establish this way to look at that issue. And then there were a handful of other things, new fines that can be charged if someone makes a 911 call to threaten or harass someone based on factors like race or ethnicity or sexual orientation, a chance to try to diversify juries by making sure that the pool of jurors are more diversified in communities.
And corporations too. Corporations also will have their feet held to the fire on this as well.
Yes, publicly held corporations must have at least one person on their board of directors who represents an underrepresented community. This is, again, is an effort to increase diversity on corporate boards. This follows after one we had about gender diversity on these boards of directors. And so this is a big change for those big corporations that are headquartered here in the state.
Now, earlier in the show, we talked about police reform on the local level here in LA County. John, what are some of the new California laws that'll change how police operate in the state as a whole?
I certainly think that first and foremost, a ban on chokeholds, which were controversial, certainly in the case of George Floyd in Minnesota, ban on chokeholds or anything that constrains a person's carotid arteries. And also a notable one to me is that California's attorney general must investigate when an officer involved shooting results in the death of an unarmed person. And this is a big one here because, in part, while that was an option before, making the attorney general and the State Department of Justice get involved in those kinds of incidents, I think, was a big moment based on what we have seen and what people believe need to be done to change the topic.
One more thing, going back to chokeholds for a second, how widely have chokeholds been used in California? And what will the new ban mean? Like, say, if an officer uses one, is he or she breaking the law now?
Well, they are breaking the law and could be subject to penalty under that. As far as the widespread use of them, I don't have a specific answer for you there. I mean, there has been some anecdotal suggestion that a lot of law enforcement agencies were not using them anymore, but this ensures they're not. And I think this sends a very strong message about the kind of police work that California considers appropriate versus inappropriate.
Speaking with John Myers, Sacramento Bureau Chief for the LA Times, about the new laws in California that went into effect January 1st. Let's get into this law banning flavored tobacco. Now, we know it's not actually taking effect this year because opponents have launched a referendum to overturn it. But what are the politics behind the original law and the challenge?
Simply put, the politics behind the law that was signed and would be taken effect if not for this political challenge were concerns about how these flavoring attracted younger smokers or younger users of the tobacco, because it's often vaping and those kinds of processes, and that the state needed to step in and needed to limit those in terms of marketing it to people under pretenses that would get them involved in tobacco at an early age. The law will be sweeping if it takes effect and will put California at the forefront of a national conversation. But as we're kind of alluding to here, let's just talk about what it is. It may very well be on hold. The tobacco industry spent a lot of money to gather voter signatures to qualify a referendum for the 2022 ballot. All those signatures have not completely been vetted yet, but we expect that law to be put on hold and voters will have to decide whether that law goes forward or not in a couple of years. If it does, California, again, at the forefront of banning these flavored tobacco products. Of course, voters could turn around and say the legislature was wrong. We'll see.
All right. Now to the issue of family leave, new state law going into effect that's going to expand the program. Fill us in on those details.
This is probably one of the more interesting ones in terms of the workplace, because California's laws about who would get time off for work for a family member who needed something were limited to the size of the employment place. And so now under the new law, businesses with as few as 5 employees, so these are very small businesses, have to provide unpaid family and medical leave up to 12 weeks, guaranteeing that the person's job is protected when they leave. It had a higher threshold earlier. There were a couple of different ways to look at this, but this means that very small businesses will have to give those workers time away that they need the care for loved ones, and that those jobs have to be protected, that they can't lose their job when they take this time off.
Another bill that broadly has to do with wellness involves how private insurance companies have to cover mental health coverage. So, John, tell us about that law and what it'll mean for Californians.
It simply means that mental health is going to have to be treated the same way that other health conditions are. It brings mental health coverage under the umbrella of other health services. And I think that is a big step to not treat mental health needs differently under the insurance that's provided to Californians, making sure that there is some parity here with physical health and mental health.
All right, looking ahead, John, we know there were hundreds of laws that did not make it to Governor Newsom's desk last year after the pandemic really threw off the legislative schedule. So what are some of the most significant laws you expect to see coming out of the California legislature in 2021?
I think that I would probably focus at this point on topics probably more than individual laws, though I know some of the things that did move forward will probably come back again. And I would say, too, that we've talked about a lot here, Obviously, the COVID-19 pandemic, we're going to see more efforts there in terms of the workplace. I think we're also going to see some efforts from Republican members of the legislature to push back in ways about what requirements that employers and businesses have to comply with in terms of COVID protection. So I think there's going to be a robust debate there. And we're going to see more about policing and racial justice, absolutely. There is still a sense by some activists that the legislature has been too friendly to law enforcement groups, and they want more accountability, more restrictions. They want a better sense of like what it means to be held criminally liable by a law enforcement officer and what's a justified shooting or not. And so those things have not moved forward as much in years past. I certainly think we're going to have that conversation again here in 2021.
All right, that's John Meyer, Sacramento Bureau Chief for the LA Times, telling us about all the new California laws that went into effect January 1st. John, Happy New Year.
Thank you. Happy New Year.
This is the last day I'm saying Happy New Year, by the way. This is it. The deadline is today. All right, when it comes to historical landmark designations for buildings, the debate usually centers on how the building looks. I mean, is the architecture of the structure so significant or so artistically timeless that it needs protection? Now, that's usually how it goes, except in the case of one little place off the corner of Western and Franklin. Find out all about it when Take Two continues in about 60 seconds. Stay with us. Back now with more Take Two on 89.3 KPCC and available on Apple Podcasts. I'm Ian Martinez. As the song says, they pay paradise and put up a parking lot. Okay, I know. I'm more of a dancer than a singer. I get that. Now, it's not a new story in LA where it seems like things are always changing, but there is the hope of a beloved spot becoming a registered landmark. It's a designation that could save a small boxy building near the Rite Aid at Western and Franklin, not known for its architectural significance, but for the significant contribution its one-time occupier made to LA's art scene. Artist Corita Kent was an activist, a teacher, and a former nun, and some of her most colorful pop art was done on silk screens in that small box of a studio that is now a Hollywood dry cleaner. Just before the holidays, the public weighed in on its fate at a meeting of the LA Cultural Heritage Commission. KPCC's Micah Kilbon tuned in on Zoom and watched the unexpected unfold.
Item 6 is proposed monument designation for the Sister Mary Corita Studio. The staff recommendation is that the commission not declare the property an historic monument.
So yeah, the odds were not great for the survival of this building. The Cultural Heritage Commission hears arguments for and against historical designations and then makes a ruling on the matter. In many cases, it holds the power to save a structure. And the argument to not save Corita Kent's studio from demolition was that the site had been so significantly altered it no longer resembled its 1960s self. So at that moment, last month, it was almost certainly destined to become parking spaces. But then, public comment began.
Here is where the rubber meets the road, commissioners. Something significant happened here, period. That's the room where the magic happened.
She's a giant artist. Art is power.
Women's liberation is the liberation of the feminine in the man and the masculine in the woman. It's a pretty dope quote from a nun born in 1918.
It went on for an entire hour, with family and former students of Carita Kent weighing in. The commission's president, Richard Barron, said it was the most comment he'd heard in 15 years. And that, it had an effect. Here's Richard Barron.
Although when it first came before us, I was not supportive of this being a monument, I've changed my mind.
Euphoric isn't the right word, but it's a little bit of that.
This is Adrian Scott Fine, director of advocacy at the LA Conservancy, a nonprofit working to save the building.
In terms of the work that we do in preservation, it's about connecting places to people. Here was a case where the people, they got it.
You might be wondering, what's so special about this ordinary storefront that so many are calling to be saved? To answer that, you need to know more about the art created within its walls and about the woman who created it. Frances Elizabeth Kent was born in Iowa in 1918, eventually moving to Los Angeles with her family. At age 18, she joined the Religious Order of the Immaculate Heart of Mary in Los Feliz and became Sister Mary Carita. She eventually joined the art department at the Immaculate Heart College. But Sister Mary Carita was not your typical teacher, or your typical nun. She challenged her students to think beyond traditional conventions by reinterpreting the landscape that was Los Angeles.
The landscape and the trees and the flowers and the cut grass, this is a kind of landscape which we call nature, and we love this. The other kind of landscape, the kind that's down Sunset Boulevard, is a man-made thing. These are both landscapes, you see. I think one is not better than the other, and I think one is not more delightful than the other.
That's Kent in a 1967 film that showed her working in her silkscreen studio, that little box in Hollywood we've been talking about. In her own art, she reimagined billboards and advertising in a bright, vivid conversation between God and, well, everything. And the building where it all happened is, put nicely, utilitarian.
I don't think anyone's arguing that it's the most beautiful space, but I think that that's some of the magic.
This is Nellie Scott, the director of the Carita Art Center.
She asked her students to look and look again. And so the fact that it is such an ordinary box, you know, it's something you would walk by every single day.
Sister Mary Carita became known as the Pop Art Nun. She was on the cover of Newsweek and was named an LA Times Woman of the Year. Some of her most famous work recreated food packaging, like the circles from the Wonder Bread bag. And it was printed in that little studio after taking her students across the parking lot to find inspiration in a grocery store. Here's Scott again.
So she would take her students into the market basket, and she often used photography to find source material. And then they would march across the parking lot into this space and begin screen printing.
She became known as Carita Kent in the 1970s, when she left the order and also left LA. This is the only remaining building in the city tied to Kent's work. The Immaculate Heart, however, no longer owns it or controls its fate.
And when we found out that it was set for demolition, it just was a gut punch. A plaque just wouldn't do it justice. I do think that if this was one of her male contemporaries' art studios, we would already be cutting the ribbon.
The only way to save the building was to apply for and get historic designation. But through that process, Scott found out that only about 3% of historic cultural monuments in LA are associated with women's history.
There's so many different stories, certainly around women's heritage, that are not included.
Adrian Scott Fine again.
And for the remaining buildings that we have, which it's a finite resource and we're losing them on a regular basis, we're playing catch up. And certainly Sister Carita is a core part of that.
Most of the city's historically recognized buildings are architectural gems. But Fine argues that if this not so pretty building can be saved because of who worked there, it could change the way Los Angeles thinks about its history and how we preserve it. In the end, the LA Cultural Heritage Commission turned out to be in favor of that way of thinking.
Yes.
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 Yes. The motion carries.
Changing our perspective on what's a landmark, it turns out, takes some artistic viewing. Carita Kent taught her students slow looking to find a new perspective, and this little building makes it clear we can still learn from her. The vote whether to save the studio where she did her most influential work goes to the city council later in January. But if members' response to public support is anything like that of the commissioner's, things are looking good. For Take Two, I'm Micah Kielbon.
And thank you to the Corita Arts Center for providing archival audio from Thomas Conrad's 1967 film, Alleluia. I mean, really, this had to be the best Take Two show of 2021. The absolute best show of 2021. If you want to hear any of it, if you missed any of it, just head to wherever you get your podcast. There we will be waiting to be heard by you. We're also on Twitter at Take Two. I'm there as well at A Martinez LA. That's at A Martinez LA. Thanks for listening. Thanks for trusting us with your time. Take Two is back tomorrow at 2. Talk to you then.